Our next speaker is Zeke Hasenfeld, professor at UCLA.
Well, I'm afraid it's welfare bashing day, so a little more of the same. So the welfare reform of 1996 is depicted in historic institutional transformation of welfare by reversing the entitlement to cash aid and replacing it with a work requirement. As a result, the welfare offices are said to move from a culture of eligibility to a culture of employment by assisting welfare recipients to become gainfully employed. Yet viewed from a broader historical perspective, I'm proposing that the reform, rather than being a radical change, has actually reinforced a long-standing institutional logic about poverty and welfare, and that the welfare offices, in fact, have remained steeped in a culture of eligibility. The institutional logic of welfare has been with us for a long time, all the way from the early days of ADC. First, welfare mothers have always been viewed as outsiders, and therefore the question of deservingness pervades much of the welfare administration. Second, giving public aid is always seen as a threat to the work ethic, and therefore the condition and amount of aid have always forced recipients to work. Third, dependence on aid is viewed as morally corrupting. And fourth, welfare is always about upholding the dominant moral code regarding family relations, gender, and ethnicity. And fifth, giving aid always involved a stereotype and moral degradation of the recipients. So throughout the history of welfare, the core task of the welfare office has basically remained relatively unchanged. They must first and foremost determine and redetermine who is deserving for aid. Second, the condition of aid are set such that, in effect, they constitute a work test. And thirdly, they enforce compliance by rooting out fraud. The persistence of the institutional logic of welfare can be attributed, in my judgment, to the dominance of two powerful meta-institutional logics on the market capitalism and sanctity of the family. The institutional logic of market capitalism upholds the moral importance of the work ethic and individual responsibility and the practice of a self-regulating market unfettered by government interference. Failure to work is a moral deficiency, and dependence on public assistance is a threat to the market logic. The regulation of gender relations, procreation, and parenthood is epitomized in a meta-logic of the family. It is constituted by the moral principle of marriage and regulating intimate gender relations and in family formation, and in the practice of a two-parent family in which proper parenthood, family wage, and child rearing are enacted. Both the logic of the market and the family result in what is called the perversity thesis, in which it is argued that it's public assistance that causes poverty. Not surprisingly, then, much of the history of welfare is marked by demonizing single mothers, especially those from racial and ethnic minorities. The meta-logic of the market and family are challenged periodically as material conditions change. For example, during the rise of the civil rights and the legal rights movement in the 1960s, poverty lawyers, coupled with the National Welfare Rights Organization, successfully challenged several welfare exclusionary practices. However, the resulting rise in the welfare rolls brought with it strong welfare backlash. And as noted by Alan Reese, opposition to welfare became highly racialized, new work requirements were imposed, welfare was cast as rife with fraud and waste, and state froze their grant aids. Therefore, the core moral rules and practices of welfare have remained in force. Looking at TANF, although it is framed as a radical reform, in effect it represents a reaffirmation of the meta-logic of the market and family, and therefore a long-standing institutional logic of welfare. Because of the political and ideological dominance of socially conservative interest groups that firmly embrace the perversity thesis, welfare has successfully rolled back some practices enacted in previous decades, such as entitlement to cash aid, which were viewed as a threat to that logic. TANF has been compared to the English New Poor Law of 1834, and I think more appropriately to the response to the poor during the Gilded Age in the 19th century America. It also echoes, of course, the early practices of ADC. First, welfare is no longer, as Evelyn pointed out, welfare is no longer an entitlement. Second, work test is a cornerstone of TANF. And third, TANF imposes a family code. And fourth, TANF relies heavily on sanctions to impose compliance. Also, TANF has devolved and privatized administration of welfare to the local level. And in that way, TANF also reinforced what has always been a local animosity toward welfare recipients. Welfare became caught in the struggle among contending interest groups that vie for the share of the state and local resources, and it usually loses out. Matthew Fellows and Gretchen Rowe find that states enacting strict eligibility requirements, more rigid work requirements, and less generous cash benefits have higher proportion of African-American recipients, are ideologically less liberal, and have a higher income representational bias, and are dominated by Republican legislators. Not only are there variation among the states, but there are often considerable differences in how counties and local municipalities in the state implement their welfare-to-work programs. Richard Fording and colleagues, including Sandy, in their study of counties in Florida, point out that counties which are more politically conservative, that have higher poverty rates, also have higher sanction rates. Coupled with devolution, privatization also reinforces the incentive to reduce costs and shift the responsibility for welfare recipients away from government. To the recipients, it adds another set of barriers to access services. For welfare officials, privatization is an attractive strategy. By shifting the burden of managing recipients with employment and behavioral problems to other service providers, welfare officers shield themselves from the need to restructure or augment their own practices. Moreover, welfare departments can exonerate themselves from failing to meet the needs of the recipients by putting their responsibility on the shoulders of the service providers. In many respects, contracting out produces a collusion between welfare officials and powerful contractors because each party can gain side benefits such as political support and excess profit. Reviewing both the subsidies to private institutions during the Gilded Age and the contracting under TANF, Stephen Pimper concludes, and I quote, whether it's subsidies of the late 19th century or the more recent welfare contract, reform has not saved money as many proponents have proposed. It has redistributed it. In an environment of devolution of privatization and with renewed emphasis on work, local welfare offices are expected to transform themselves into employment agency. But the very forces that produce the culture and practice of eligibility determination still prevail and are even strengthened under TANF. First and foremost, the punitive approach, setting time limits, making aid contingent on mandatory work requirements, and using sanction to enforce compliance, signal and justify treating recipients as pathologically dependent on welfare, lacking the work ethic, and shirking their responsibility as mature adults and parents. Second, welfare offices face strong pressure to reduce the welfare rolls, meet the federal quotas, curb costs, and comply with accountability measures that are based on quantity rather than quality, as Evelyn pointed out. Third, and most important, the entrenched bureaucratic structure used to spread eligibility and to enforce compliance crowds out alternative structure needed to provide employment services. Welfare officials has essentially incorporated the new work requirements into their existing bureaucratic practices, putting the onus on their recipients through coercive means. So in a sense, what welfare offices have done, they've adopted what's called the Work First Court Service Technology, which seeks to move the recipients into employment as quickly as possible. With some variation, the core technology consists of mandatory job club job search, in which recipients learn how to prepare a resume, search for a job, and interview for employment. In addition, recipients may receive supportive services such as assistance in childcare and transportation. Work First result in modest, if any, economic benefits to recipients. Yet Work First has been institutionalized as a dominant service technology because it's been shown to reduce the welfare rolls and it saves government money. It employs ceremonies of sending recipients to job club job search as confirmation that little preparation, but rather motivation, is needed to find a job. It comports well with the eligibility culture of the welfare offices by providing a readily available work test. The service technology is easily routinized, does not entail implementing complex employment services, and Work First is relatively inexpensive, require limited case management expertise, and it has a virtue of deterring application and hastening exit. And then we have sanctions. Sanctions are a defining feature of the welfare to work and frame much of the encounters between workers and recipients. Use of sanctions minimize emotional work and its effective way to discourage entry and to hasten exit. Sanctions are widely used. Studies show that a majority of welfare recipients ranging from 45 to 60% experience sanctions. Those who are sanctioned are usually the most vulnerable recipients with the greatest employment barriers. And studies show that the sanctions have not necessarily produced a desired behavioral change. Most importantly, sanctions increase food, rent, and utility hardship. Therefore, sanctions are indeed a ceremonial enactment and confirmation of the myth that welfare recipients are undeserving. And the use of sanction is a way to typify the recipient's problem as a failure to comply. The myth of the welfare office has been transformed into an employment agency, is extended through symbols. The title of the welfare workers has changed. In Michigan, they are now called, instead of assistant payment workers, they are now called family independence specialists. In Texas, they are now called works advisors. But at the front line, most welfare offices incorporated the work requirements into the old culture. Indeed, there's a wide gap between the organizational myth and the behavior of the welfare workers on the ground. In their study of implementation of TANF in 11 sites, Irene Lurie and Norma Carucci find that although their spouse goals emphasize employment and self-sufficiency, the front line continue to be driven by accuracy in determining eligibility and benefits and getting the work done on time. As they write themselves, the eligibility interviews we observed usually mentioned the need to work and always referred applicants to the work agency, but very little time was spent discussing work or coaching the clients about employment. So, to conclude, welfare reform has been hailed as a major policy success. What is glossed over is the fact that under welfare reform, the welfare office has created draconian barriers to entry and set harsh measures to hasten exit, which account for so much of the decline in the welfare role. First of all, applying for welfare has become exceedingly difficult through practices such as diversion, numerous application procedures, and excessive documentation. In California, the application rates rose from 2004 to 2009 by 30%, but the caseload remained essentially unchanged. In New York, as Michael had mentioned, the number of applications actually has risen by 35% from 1999 to 2007, and the welfare rolls have actually declined. Second, there has been a major reduction in the proportion of families eligible for TANF, as Evelyn pointed out. I would like to stress that actually the share of poor children receiving cash assistance declined from 62% in 1995 to 31% in 2003. And thirdly, that there's a huge, big, significant rise in disconnected poor single mothers who are not working and do not receive any or very limited cash assistance. Rebecca Blank estimates that about 20 to 25% of low-income single mothers are disconnected. They are women with multiple barriers, such as limited education, substance abuse, mental illness, caring for disabled children, experience with domestic abuse, and living in high poverty area. Therefore, in the final analysis, welfare offices continue their historical role to demonize the poor, discourage them from applying, enforce rigid eligibility requirements, administer a work test, punish those that fail to comply, and push for an early exit.
Thanks very much, Zeke. Next up, we have Fan Patran, Professor of Social Work and Social Research at Bryn Mawr College.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm honored to be here, replacing Joe Soss, who couldn't make it. Along with Joe and Richard Fording, we're working on welfare to work in Florida. And I have to say, our work is very much informed by the work of many of the people in the audience and on the panel today. And if it wasn't for all your good work, we wouldn't be able to have the jobs that we do. So I'm really delighted to be here today. Having said that, there's so much already that's been said that I agree with. I feel on one level it's almost unnecessary for me to... I was going to tell this joke first, actually, that nobody over 60 should do certain things in public, like PowerPoint. what do you know? It worked. But on the other hand, I think the more we talk, I hear things that I don't quite agree with. As much as Zeke and Joel Handler's work has informed ours, and his presentation I thought was most eloquent and well-grounded in the research, and there's a lot I agree with, our argument based on our research is that things are really changing. Now, I'm a student of Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward, and I do believe that welfare is a secondary institution calibrated to serve the needs of the market and the state, serving political and economic purposes. In a cyclical fashion, it shifts, giving emphasis one to the other, depending on circumstances. And we have gone through a period of a cyclical shift back to a more punitive disciplinary regime that has facilitated welfare retrenchment in recent years. But I think Piven and Cloward were at pains to emphasize that every time we shift back, it's not quite the same. I mean, history doesn't really repeat itself. It just seems that way. Or as Marx said, the second time it's tragedy, or the second time it's farce, and the third time it's tragedy. Our argument is that things really are changing in this era of retrenchment, and that we're moving in a direction that is somewhat different. It's not really quite then, in that sense, I think, a new gilded age. What we argue is that we're moving towards a system of what we call neoliberal paternalism. Neoliberalism is a term that is bandied about quite a bit, and I want to emphasize that the liberal here is not political liberal, but classically economic liberalism, Adam Smithian sort of liberalism. So it's a new kind of market-centered approach. And I disagree with Block and Summers as much as their work has informed us. I don't think it's a return to a more laissez-faire kind of approach. Instead, neoliberalism is very much about embedding market logic in the state, where the state is preoccupied with learning to function in market-like ways to facilitate the growth of market logic throughout society. And Another stream of influence that is making our era somewhat distinctive is this new paternalism that people like Larry Mead and others have talked about, which has become quite prominent in social policy administration, not just in the United States and not just in the developed world, but is spreading through the developing world as well, as recent reports have been indicating, with these new types of incentive schemes that are, I think, in over 42 different developing countries now. In an era of fast-track global social policy, we're seeing the dissemination of these kinds of ideas. And so we argue that we're entering, yes, a more restrictive era of retrenchment that has been going on for some time, but one that has its own distinctive cast that we call neoliberal paternalism, that involves some very concrete kinds of features, the new public management, devolution, privatization, performance competition. I think all of these new developments represent a significant kind of organizational change in the administration of social policy and affect how frontline workers do get to exercise discretion in a more devolved, privatized, performance-based context. That use of discretion, I think, is no longer the same as when Michael so brilliantly characterized it originally in the book Street Level Bureaucracy. There's a new world there. And this new world involves a different type of punitive approach to people. For a long time, welfare in the United States tried to enforce work through the principle of less eligibility, which for several hundred years influenced the Anglo world, where benefits were supposed to be below the lowest level of wages. But now it's more through, as Zeke was mentioning, through such things as time limits and sanctions in particular. So it's as if, we like to argue, we're moving from regulating the poor to disciplining the poor, where we're more interested in a 24/7 kind of approach to look at enforcing work on clients through a system of continuous monitoring and surveillance. So we tried to find out about this by studying Florida as a welfare to work system. Florida is very much considered an innovator. It has high use of sanctions, a state-of-the-art performance management system. It has second-order devolution, where it turns welfare over to the workforce boards in the 24 regions, and they rely on for-profit contractors largely, and actually 16 of the 24 regions rely on one contractor, Arbor Rescare from Manoa, Pennsylvania, which is right near my house, so that interview wasn't too arduous. And we looked at how they use this performance management system to enforce contract compliance. They have this very popular red and green report, which, as you might imagine, red means you're not meeting your requirements, and green mean you're doing quite well. And all of the contractors very much preoccupied with this. So we've been in Florida for over 5 years. Our research is basically done now. We used mixed methods, and we today are going to summarize some of our major findings regarding performance measurement. And I have to say that the performance management system in Florida leads to a lot of sanctioning. And our field research basically tried to demonstrate, well, what is the causal mechanism behind these high rates of sanctioning that we found? And basically, it's a story of perversity, that devolution is supposed to lead to experimentation and innovation, that performance feedback is supposed to increase learning, and competition is supposed to lead to better practices, and that this would advance statewide policy goals. But what we find is that previous studies are right, that there is sub-optimizing, there is creaming, there is tunnel vision, there is the social policy equivalent of teaching to the test, where workers are preoccupied with meeting their numbers. Our field interviews were quite consistent in the four regions that we studied in showing that case managers are totally preoccupied with their computers and their numbers at the expense of helping their clients. In theory, competition was supposed to encourage regions to learn from one another's, but as one of my informants said, we can't learn from other regions. Those are industrial secrets. In practice, learning depended on trust, but what we saw was that tremendous amount of distrust. Another informant said their best practice in referring to another region is cheating. So the perversity, I think, though, extended to the meeting of program goals. Local organizations, in practice, must decide how to respond to meet these goals, and they were really quite innovative in developing a lot of the things that Zeke was talking about earlier. I think it's really true that in Florida, the roles which underwent a massive decline was largely due to preventing people from accessing assistance in the beginning more than anything else. And we saw that again and again, that the process of work registration, as it's called in Florida, can be quite arduous, and regions have a lot of discretion in how they vary in setting up work registration. So in some regions, you would have to work 40 hours a week attending sessions full-time without any benefits or child care before you qualify to receive any assistance at all. And so in some ways, you have to wonder whether this really is the kind of approach that is encouraging regions to meet program goals in the best possible way or not. Also, another thing that's really interesting, and I think we see this more and more as welfare as reformed in the United States, is calling for integration with workforce development, and Florida's way ahead on this, is that since these regions have multiple programs and they're not just on welfare, they often give short shrift to welfare as sort of the weak sister of the programs. And we call this stream creaming, where the resources are diverted to the other programs where they have performance measures to meet, and they consider welfare sort of a lost leader. So we did field research in one region, which was quite interesting. This region, we interviewed the program managers over a three-year period because they were very concerned about their bad numbers, and they felt that they had a lot of people who weren't with the program. And so they went through in 2005 this rather serious transformation, and they created, a very arduous upfront work registration procedure that made it extremely difficult for people to access assistance in the beginning. Further, once people did get assistance, they were often much more likely to be sanctioned, trying, I guess, under the idea of getting rid of hard-to-serve clients, that people couldn't really get back on the rolls unless they cured their sanction. And in this one region, one of their innovations was to create a sanction queen, as they called her. This was a caseworker who was the person you had to go see in person in order to cure your sanction, and she was only available to see all clients that had a sanction Tuesday afternoons from 2 to 4 p.m. She reminded me of some of my colleagues. But not at my current institution.
No.
But these kinds of procedures, I think, are quite eye-opening. It shows you what kind of discretion they have. We have lots of other data, and I don't really have a lot of time. But in Congress, Florida is considered an innovator, a pioneer. There are congressional hearings that you can read where members of Congress try to champion Florida as the kind of state to follow in the future of welfare reform, which raises the question of what do we really mean by success? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Schramm. Our final presenter is Celeste Watkin Hayes, a professor of sociology and African American studies at Northwestern, our neighbor just to the north.
Thank you so much. And Megan, where is Megan? If people want to see copies of my slides, because I have some quotes on here that are pretty long, so if we could distribute those, or if you could pull those out, that would be great. Good morning, everyone. I want to first thank Evelyn for putting this together and to say it's so good to be in dialogue again with my co-panelists. We have been in conversation quite a bit over the last couple of years, so it's great to hear about their latest work. So in recent years, racial and ethnic minorities have increasingly joined the employee ranks of human service agencies. So for example, while blacks constitute about 10.9% of the total labor force, this was in 2006, they constituted one-fourth of those determining eligibility for individuals applying for public programs, such as temporary assistance for needy families, what we've been talking about today, food stamps, unemployment benefits, Social Security, and public housing. So as the faces of more and more of these institutions that we've been talking about, bureaucrats of color join their coworkers in articulating agency goals and expectations, brokering services, and enforcing policies. So their contributions and presence among the power-wielding ranks in public institutions are therefore an important part of the story of how social welfare policies and services are formulated and reworked on the ground. So scholars of street-level bureaucracies have made critical strides in parsing out the impact of racial and ethnic diversity within these agencies on policies and institutional practices. So determining and measuring the effects of what we might call representative bureaucracies is an established area in the field. And it's based on a theory that an agency's goals are better represented when a staff is diverse, when it better represents and reflects the backgrounds of its constituents. So the hypothesis, to be more explicit, is that the unique interests of minority clients are better served and better represented in agency staffed with racial and ethnic minorities than by agency staffed only with non-Hispanic whites. And there are several empirical studies to support this claim within kind of a parallel track of research to street-level bureaucracy work, which many of us do, and that's this kind of racial representative bureaucracy work. So as the body of literature develops to highlight the significance of the racial composition of public institution workforces on client outcomes, less is known about how clients themselves interpret, assess, and navigate these demographic shifts that we're seeing in these institutions. So it's widely assumed, for example, that clients of color both recognize and embrace racial diversity within street-level bureaucracies and interpret it as working to their advantage. However, institutional constraints, in-group politics, and the changing nature of policy have the potential to shape the relationship between minority bureaucrats and minority clients in ways that change the possibilities for quote-unquote representation in racially representative bureaucracies. So this brings me to the research questions that I want to talk about today. Do clients of color, and I'm speaking specifically about blacks and Latinos in this context, believe that the racial makeup of the bureaucratic staff matters within the welfare offices in which they frequent? How do they believe that race, class, and other social characteristics shape their interactions with caseworkers, and how do they respond to these dynamics? I'm just going to go ahead and give you a preview of the argument. And we're using interview data from 22 women and men who have recently received cash and or food stamps from the Massachusetts Departmental of Transitional Assistance. So what we're going to do is kind of explore how Black and Latino clients negotiate race and their attendant politics within a racially diverse office. And we're going to focus specifically on the relationships between Black and Latino clients and Black and Latino bureaucrats. There's a whole other story that we can talk about when we talk about white clients and white bureaucrats. So, and while this isn't the focus of the analysis, I'm also going to bring in some caseworker data just to talk about how caseworkers think about this relationship as well. So in terms of the three points I want to bring to you today, I find that despite the racial and ethnic diversity of the staff, most Black and Latino clients do not view Black and Latino staff members as operating in ways that are distinctly racialized. And I'll talk about what that means throughout the talk. As an explanation for why clients don't see many clear examples of what we might call active representation, this idea that the racial composition of the staff may work to one's advantage in terms of addressing discrimination, in terms of equality and fairness, I'm going to point to a strong bureaucratic structure, much of which we've already heard about, and class dynamics that shape the interactions between clients and caseworkers. And these factors often generate boundaries between clients and caseworkers that are often intractable and prevent some of the meaningful interaction and engagement despite social group commonality. So when interactions do take place, going to the second point, that clients read as racially infused, they're not monolithically interpreted, and we're going to talk about that more in a minute as well. Clients can read this as either pointed in terms of the interactions between race-mate bureaucrats. Clients can read these as either pointed and welcome observations and interventions by race-mates who can offer wisdom on how to negotiate the welfare system, or they can be read as heavy-handed maneuvers by more privileged members of their racial community. So what I want to do is kind of complicate how we're thinking about the racial composition of these institutions and point to some of the intra-racial dynamics that are happening with the group, between the groups. In terms of how I'm grounding this in literature, I'm really thinking about this in terms of kind of what we know about street-level bureaucracies and what we know about racially representative bureaucracies. So on the left hand, I kind of point to some of the things that we know about what we call street-level bureaucracies. So we've talked about this heavy bureaucratic structure. We've talked about the ways in which discretion is used to either minimize or maximize support and or surveillance of clients. We've talked about how policy is quote-unquote remade on the ground. We talked about discretion within a context of bureaucratic constraints, and we also talked about a need for understanding how race and class operate in light of shifting staff shifts. For a long time, we really focused a lot on shifting client demographic shifts, but as I pointed out before, with the increasing diversity of the work force within these institutions, it's important to think about when workers are members of racial and ethnic groups, minority groups, what this means as well. On the right side, some critical points on kind of racially representative bureaucracy theory. This notion that it ultimately sees bureaucrats as quite powerful in their abilities to shape organizational outcomes in terms of their ability to deploy politics to make sure that discrimination is addressed, equality is sought for, and examples and role models are presented within an agency. The demographic of the work composition of the workforce, therefore, is thought to shape client outcomes and experiences. But at the same time, one of the critiques of this literature is there's a limited accounting for the political and racial and socioeconomic diversity within communities of color. So that is to say, what do we mean by quote-unquote minority group interests, and who determines what that means? And we know from much of the work coming out in sociology and other fields that much of what is meant by racial group interests sometimes it is representative of the more privileged members of a particular racial group, those who are middle class, those who are men, those who are heterosexual. So we've got to kind of think about that diversity when we think about this notion of racial group representation within a bureaucracy. So in terms of the data and the method, this project is really kind of an offshoot of the other work that I do. I typically focus on caseworkers and have a book coming out in about a month, on caseworkers in Massachusetts. So this is my kind of foray into client work. So coming back to where I was in graduate school. So we're focusing today on 22 in-depth interviews conducted in the summer of 2008, 19 women, 3 men who received cash assistance and or food stamps in the last 12 months. And it's important to note that many of these people in the study are just receiving food stamps at the time that I interviewed them, although they had experience with cash assistance in the previous time. And it really points to what my co-panelists are saying about the kind of lack of accessibility of cash benefits and the fact that we're seeing more and more low-income families who are interacting with the welfare office to get food stamps and food stamps only. In terms of the demographics, we have 14 Latinas, 6 non-Hispanic blacks, 2 whites. We have 10 working at recruitment, all with household incomes between $15,000 and $25,000, average of 1 to 6 children. Average number of children, clients have between 1 and 6 children with an average of 2.5 children. None were married at recruitment. A third of the clients were living with their mothers, and half of the women were in relationships and talked about their intimate partners as kind of sources for economic support. So we know from previous work, I'm thinking of Rasusi and Myers, and I'm also thinking about a paper that I just published in the journal Social Problems, that caseworkers of color, particularly blacks and Latinos, often see themselves as having outlooks and values regarding the welfare system that are shaped in part by their racial group memberships. So their beliefs about clients' opportunities and constraints are in fact influenced in part by their own biographically informed understanding of racial stratification and its impact on economic opportunity. So while there's little evidence so far to suggest that these views shape bureaucratic outcomes in service delivery, these beliefs have been documented to inform organizational processes of service delivery. So for example, in the piece that I just talked about in Social Problems, my finding is that black and Latino caseworkers and supervisors engage in what I call racialized professionalism as they integrate race into their understanding and operationalization of their work and their goals for what it should accomplish. So they actively and strategically deploy race and class and gender by shaping the content and tone of their interactions with black and Latino clients in ways that reflect both key priorities in welfare reform, but also intra-group politics within their communities. So they're leveraging racial commonality to communicate the social goals and political motives of welfare policy to race-made clients, and they're attempting to use their occupational authority and their social status as more privileged members of a racial community, often slightly more privileged members of a racial community, to articulate why their clients should adopt a certain set of behaviors. Social class ends up being a key aspect, as workers' biographies are occasionally drawn upon by these workers, occasionally and strategically. So Sandra, a caseworker in the office that I study, was on AFDC for 15 years, 15 years ago, and when she was raising her son. And she had this to say about how she approaches her casework and how she thinks her biography informs her casework. So she has this to say, and I refer you to the handouts because we're going to have a lot of words on the slides, unfortunately. So to me, my background gives me a better understanding of where my clients are coming from. I know what it's like to sit in that chair because I sat there at one time myself. It's not that much different from sitting over here. It's just more paperwork. You truly understand because you sat on that side of the table and you've asked somebody to give you a slice of bread too. You know how demeaning that can be. You know how it makes you feel the person isn't responding that you're asking for, or if you're being demeaned, or that you're being demeaned even by asking for it. So Sandra's empathy for clients ends up being kind of strategically invoked, but it's not always, and I use the word strategically purposely, as she goes on to say, I don't share that I was on welfare with all of my clients, but sometimes when I see a woman being stuck and not knowing what she wants to go, and she sees a set it's all kinds of roadblocks, I say, I understand what you mean because I had to make a decision like this at one time too. Whatever is there, use it to the best of your ability. Or I'll say, I understand your struggle because I'm of the same struggle. I've been there and done that. But if you keep persevering, you can make a change. But you've got to want it and work for it and be able to seize the opportunity when it does happen for you. We can sit and talk all day about not having this or not having that. So how do clients read this in these kind of strategic moments where workers are using their biographies that are informed by class but often inflected implicitly or explicitly by race? Andre had this to say about his caseworker. It's just the way that we interact with each other, and him being a black male and certain things he has had in his life as far as like challenges, struggles, and obstacles. When you can sit down and communicate with somebody on the same level and page about what you've been through, you know, this is not a person reading this out of a book. They know by personal experience as far as me being a black man. However, less than half of the respondents actually talked about having an expectation that race would matter when they went into the agency. And more often than not, it was the caseworkers themselves that they saw kind of using this ideology to help direct them. So let me quickly tell the story of Jackie and Teresa. Jackie was being asked about the paternity of one of her children's fathers and didn't disclose the information and didn't know the information. And she had an African-American female caseworker. This is an African-American female client, and this is what she has to say about the caseworker. I was just kind of honest and told them, you know, I don't really know. It was between two people, and for one, I didn't have a last name. I guess when you're young, you know, you make mistakes. Teresa was kind of understanding. She just asked and took as much information as she could and gave me a lecture through it all, you know. I mean, it was just a lot of being a young woman. Oh, it was a lot. It was a lot. She honestly thought she was more of a mom figure, you know. You grow from your mistakes and just trying to basically send me in the right direction of getting my life started on a positive, better note. You learn from your mistakes. You don't want to go down that path again. You don't want to be just out there running around just hanging out. It's time to go back and get your education, and it's time to be a mom. It's things like that, positive. So then I asked Jackie, do you think it mattered that this was another African-American female giving you this advice? And she had this to say. I think a white woman could have said somewhat the same thing, but that, again, it was more of the same race, too. I think that she felt that she could say it, you know. She was talking from different aspects, different angles, one from being a DTA worker, one from being a mom, one from being a sister, the colloquial term for another African-American female. Basically, I guess she didn't want to see me going down the road that I was going because she was basically saying, as an African-American woman, you know, we tend to have it a little harder. This is what you need to be doing, just as more of a positive, I could say, role model. It's important to note, though, that these interactions are both supportive and regulatory, right? In these moments in which caseworkers are intervening to talk about what clients should be doing, it's not necessarily that it's just one side. There's a level of kind of privilege that's happening where caseworkers feel as though they can kind of interact and engage in that kind of way. I'm actually going to skip that quote in the interest of time. But let me say, predominantly, though, what we saw is clients saying that they actually didn't feel as though the caseworker's race mattered in terms of interacting with other black and Latino clients. And in many ways, they felt like the agency color that was most important was red, of the bureaucracy's red tape, and the idea that race really played less a significant role than this question of respect and this question of navigating the bureaucratic red tape. One client had this to say, they just want to do their paperwork and get out of the way. They don't ask a lot of questions about you. Basically, it's just, you know, your kids' names, birth dates, et cetera, all they want is the information. It's basically like they don't even really want to know about you. Another client, I wouldn't say that it had to do with race or anything. My caseworker just seemed like she was bitter, she didn't want to be bothered. And then finally, I'm just going to jump down to the middle of the slide in terms of the relationship in terms of race. I don't have a preference whether the caseworker is a male or female, black or white. You know, as long as they treat me with respect, I treat them with respect. So this is not to suggest that race does not matter in the agency, and this isn't to suggest that the discrimination isn't taking place, because if we know from Joe Sauce's work with Sanford Schramm and Richard Fording, we are seeing, in fact, some racial disparities. But in terms of how clients are interpreting the racial demographics of the workload, this notion of respect, this notion of being treated in a positive way, and this notion of having a caseworker that helps them to navigate this bureaucratic red tape seems to be highly highly, highly important to them. And time and time again, we hear these quotes about, it doesn't matter if the person is black, white, or green, I just want to be treated well, I want to get my benefits, and I want to be treated with respect. So it's a very complicated story in the sense that we can't just say that race doesn't matter, but nor can we say that race matters in a way that is very clear and very cut and dry and very black and white. It's, in fact, quite nuanced. So with that, I'll just point you to my last couple of points. We're seeing heavy bureaucratic structures likely shape how race matters in these client bureaucratic interactions. This idea that the red tape kind of raining down on these agencies really makes it so that the interaction has to be quite efficient, quite quick, and doesn't necessarily have moments in which race can be explicitly invoked, at least from the perspective of the client. Racial representation in welfare office matters. Clients do talk about the significance of seeing a racially diverse office, but class is often the overriding factor in the relationships between themselves and clients of color in terms of being treated with respect. And the importance of local context is important to note here. I was doing this work in Massachusetts, which, as we know, is a relatively liberal state in terms of both the politics, but also welfare policy. So with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
I'm really delighted to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to read and reflect on these four terrific papers. This is a wonderful conversation getting underway. One thing that strikes me about these four papers is the point that as we think about the world of welfare policy, we're talking about a moral universe. We're talking about a universe shot through with moral categories and significancies and valences. So this is a space of discourse where ideas about suffering, deservedness, race, gender, family, and so on are being actively worked out and presented. And I think what we get from particularly the Hassenfeld paper is the sense that a certain paternalism with regard to these matters has always been there. From the Roosevelt period on. But then we learn with the Sauce et al. Paper that with each subsequent wave of policy development and reform, so say from the New Deal through the War on Poverty through welfare reform, particular paternalistic stances get institutionalized, right, and worked into the very DNA, as it were, of organizations that actually attempt to meet the needs of poor people on the ground. So that, for example, decentralization ironically extends the reach of this single dominant moral position, right, rather than freeing organizations in ways that would lead to innovation. Another way to put it is that decentralization effectively increases the surface area of influence for a particular moral regime that happens to favor a free market mythos and ethos. The mythos is important there because both classical and neoliberal ism come with a certain story of progress through the market, through the operation of the market, as well as a set of prescriptions for individual behavior in relationship to the market. And so it seems that the story of the free market, the mythos, becomes more uncontestable at the local level, while behaviors that are identified as good in that story become more and more easily enforceable But all of this doesn't just happen, right, as a direct result of the setting of welfare policy at the national level. These things happen in and through the agency of actors operating on the ground. So what we get in these papers, I think, is a movement toward what we might call a phenomenology of welfare, where we begin to make sense of policy in terms of the actual experiences of welfare professionals and clients. And I think that's a very powerful contribution collectively. My question, though, and this is sort of a Piven and Cloward type of question, is how are these experiences playing back into the national politics of welfare? Or is consciousness being molded in ways in these local organizations that might actually be suppressing the politicization of welfare? In other words, are the mythos and ethos of welfare becoming invisible, such that that people won't be able to question and challenge? So we're still talking about political constituencies here, not just professionals and clients. I think Michael Lipsky mentioned frame theory in his presentation or in the Q&A portion. What are the political framings of welfare that emerge from these local organizational contexts where policy is actually experienced and worked and enacted? Celeste Watkins-Hayes mentioned in her presentation or pointed out that part of what's happening here is the regulation of identities themselves at the intersection of race and gender and class. What's the implication of that for the politics of welfare? Evelyn Brodkin stated that citizenship itself is being reconstituted in these organizations. And so I wonder whether a shift in political consciousness, or perhaps the suppression of political consciousness, be a corollary shift to the shift that Evelyn describes. Thanks.
So we have about 10 minutes left for questions before we need to head out to lunch. So open it right up. Yeah, please. I think she'll bring it over to you.
My name is Matthias Knuth from Germany. And together with my colleague Martin, we are just in the end of a research of the new German regime of basic income support, the effects of this regime on the one-third migrant clients. And this came to my mind in the presentation by Celeste. In the other presentation, we heard so much about how the street-level bureaucrats sort of disregard people's situations, putting routines on them, and so on. And you gave good examples how being of the same background creates a deeper understanding. And we found the same in the very, very few instances where we found Turkish street-level workers in the organizations. But what is actually the effect? My impression was that actually by understanding more, they put more demands on their customers. Not necessarily in a nasty way, but in a way about knowing which buttons to push. So what would be your assessment for the overall effect on the client by having this kind of understanding on the side of the professional worker?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that. The desk on
top. But I'm pretty loud,
so. Oh, great. Thank you for that. And actually, the paper, sorry to keep referencing, that in Social Problems basically comes up with the same finding in the sense that minority bureaucrats end up
participation as it relates to welfare offices. So this is a trend that we're seeing over and over again. And what you're essentially seeing is the result of a marginalized group trying to at once change a system but still accommodate and become a part of a system and trying to navigate that balance between the two and ultimately pushing for an agenda of racial respectability, of play by the rules and maybe we'll get our rights, even if it's not, in fact, how the data bear out.
Rob?
Thanks, everyone, for great papers. So I'm really interested in this kind of subtext across the papers of a theme of continuity versus discontinuity historically. I don't know what this mic is doing to all of you. But I guess I want to kind of help the panelists come back to what I feel Omar Roberts brought some great questions together and hope that people get to reflect on his direction here and maybe just to kind of add to that. I think in terms of the Piven and Cloward references, the question of welfare as an ancillary institution here to shore up labor markets and so on, and perhaps even also as a regime to help political parties and constituencies transform, has been hinted at across the papers. I'd like to hear more about that, as it seems Omar would, and maybe perhaps in addition to the level of consciousness here, ask questions directly about this notion of regulation, which has come up, and ask the panelists to kind of unpack and be a little bit reflexive of what you're meaning by regulation in this moment, how regulation is being made and remade on the ground in these organizational frameworks to achieve broader kinds of systemic changes in political economy, right, and some of how the empirical findings are explaining some of these broader shifts of neoliberalism, to take Sandy Schramm's defining framework.
Okay. I don't know. Is this, this one works. This one works. Okay, thanks, Rob. That's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right that Omar's questions really get to this larger issue. And I think the good place to start is Celeste's work. And in fact, we also found in Florida that a growing number of the case managers are former recipients, often of color, African American as well as Latina, and that they very often trade on their insider or local knowledge in ways that reflect what Kathy Cohn from this institution calls advanced marginalization, where some members of the marginalized community get to achieve upward mobility by taking on responsibility for disciplining, surveilling, and monitoring other members of the marginalized community. And in fact, I think that this is a very poignant example of how things are changing, that it's not just devolution, privatization, performance management, but it's a system that is insidiously recruiting people from the community to discipline itself. So it's a cyclical return to a more punitive kind of approach, but represents a distinctively new form of what Foucault calls governmentality. So this new system of governance is about disciplining both case managers and clients, the community, to become a self-disciplining, compliant member of the emerging global political economy. And so there are profound political as well as economic consequences to this that go well beyond the mechanics of welfare reform implementation. I do think it is a project of, as Evelyn alluded, of reconstituting citizenship in an age of globalization.
Briefly, I think this has to be a continuing part of the conversation, particularly in the latter parts. But call me a crazy optimist. But I'm not convinced that at least American politics is that static. And perhaps it's because I'm looking down the street to the Obama mansion without putting too much weight on that. But change does happen. It doesn't just happen by itself. We didn't get here by, I think, some immutable logic. We got here by a set of political strategies that tapped into a set of possibilities. There are other possibilities, and I think Rob's question raises the issue of what would it take to tap into those? It's a fight. It's a contest. And I don't think the outcome is completely ordained. It is constrained. Some things are more possible than others. I'm very doubtful from all my work of making any claims that we've really changed the heads and hearts of the people in this process. The welfare recipients that I've spent time with and the welfare workers I've spent time with, they rationalize what happens to them, but it doesn't mean that they have become some automatons of the neoliberal state. So I'm not as convinced that we're seeing such a monolith. We are seeing these trends. We are seeing this effort. But I'm not convinced it's such a monolithic, inevitable march to this conclusion. At any rate, I hope not.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's all the time we have for this panel, but I know we're going to be continuing with these conversations throughout the day.